Chapter 25. Why, you're not seeing. Not feeling. She began impetuously, and then stopped. How could she explain to him that what revolted her was not so much the fact of his having given the little house, as soon as she and Nick had left it, to those two people of all others, though the vision of them in the sweet secret house, and under the plain trees of the terrace, drew such a trail of slime across her golden hours. No, it was not that from which she most recoiled, but from the fact that Strefford, living in luxury in Nelson Vanderlyn's house, should at the same time have secretly abetted Ellie Vanderlyn's love affairs, and allowed her for a handsome price, to shelter them under his own roof. The reproach trembled on her lip, but she remembered her own part in the wretched business, and the impossibility of avowing it to Strefford, and of revealing to him that Nick had left her for that very reason. She was not afraid that the discovery would diminish her in Strefford's eyes. He was untroubled by moral problems, and would laugh away her avowal with a sneer at Nick in his new part of moralist. But that was just what she could not bear. That anyone should cast a doubt on the genuineness of Nick's standards, or should know how far below the mess he had fallen. She remained silent, and Strefford, after a moment, drew her gently down to the seat beside him. "Uzi, upon my soul, I don't know what you're driving at. Is it me you're angry with or yourself? And what's it all about? Are you disgusted because I let the villa to a couple who weren't married? But, hang it, they're the kind that pay the highest price, and I had to earn my living somehow. One doesn't run across a bridal pair every day. She lifted her eyes to his puzzled, incredulous face. Poor Streff. No, it was not with him that she was angry. Why should she be? Even that ill-advised disclosure had told her nothing as he had not already known about him. It had simply revealed to her once more the real point of view of the people he and she lived among, had shown her that, in spite of the superficial difference, he felt as they felt, judged as they judged, was blind as they were, and as she would be expected to be, should she once again become one of them. What was the use of being placed by fortune above such shifts and compromises, if in one's heart one still condoned them? And she would have to, she would catch the general note, grow blunted as those other people were blunted, and gradually come to wonder at her own revolt, as Strefford now honestly wondered at it. She felt as though she were on the point of losing some newfound treasure, a treasure precious only to herself, but beside which all he offered her was nothing, the triumph of her wounded pride nothing, the security of her future nothing. "What is it, Susie?" he asked, with the same puzzled gentleness. Ah, the loneliness of never being able to make him understand. As he had felt lonely enough, when the flaming sword of Nick's indignation had shut her out from their paradise. But there had been a cruel bliss in the pain. Nick had not opened her eyes to new truths, but had waked in her again something which had lain unconscious under years of accumulated indifference. And that reawakened sense had never left her since, and had somehow kept her from utter loneliness, because it was a secret shared with Nick, a gift she owed to Nick, and which, in leaving her, he could not take from her. It was almost, she suddenly felt, as if he had left her with a child. "My dear girl," Strefford said, with a resigned glance at his watch, "you know we're dining at the embassy." At the embassy? She looked at him vaguely. Then she remembered. Yes, they were dining that night at the Ascots, with Strefford's cousin, the Duke of Dunes, and his wife, the handsome irreproachable young duchess, with the old gambling dowager duchess, whom her son and daughter-in-law had come over from England to see, and with other English and French guests of a rank and standing worthy of the Denises. Susie knew that her inclusion in such a dinner could mean but one thing. It was her definite recognition as Altringham's future wife. She was the little American whom one had to ask when one invited him, even on ceremonial occasions. The family had accepted her, the embassy could but follow suit. "It's late, dear, and I've got to see someone on business first, Strefford reminded her patiently. Oh, Streff, I can't. The words broke from her without her knowing what she was saying. Can't go with you, I can't go to the embassy. I can't go on any longer like this. ... She lifted her eyes to his in desperate appeal. Oh, understand, do please understand, she wailed, knowing, while she spoke, the utter impossibility of what she asked. Strefford's face had gradually paled and hardened. From sallow it turned to a dusky white, and lines of obstinacy deepened between the ironic eyebrows and about the weak, amused mouth. Understand? What do you want me to understand? He laughed. That you're trying to chuck me already? She shrank at the sneer of the lady, but instantly remembered that it was the only thing he could be expected to say, since it was just because he couldn't understand that she was flying from him. Oh, Streff, if I knew how to tell you. It doesn't so much matter about the how. Is that what you're trying to say? Her head drooped, and she saw the dead leaves whirling across the path at her feet, lifted on a sudden wintry gust. The reason, he continued, clearing his throat with a stiff smile, is not quite as important to me as the fact. She stood speechless, agonized by his pain. But still, she thought, he had remembered the dinner at the embassy. The thought gave her courage to go on. It wouldn't do, Streff. I'm not a bit the kind of person to make you happy. Oh, leave that to me please, won't you? No, I can't. Because I should be unhappy too. He clicked at the leaves as they whirled past. Who have taken a rather long time to find it out. She saw that his newborn sense of his own consequence was making him suffer even more than his wounded affection, and that again gave her courage. If I've taken long, it's all the more reason why I shouldn't take longer. If I've made a mistake, it's you who would have suffered from it. ... Thanks, he said, for your extreme solicitude. She looked at him helplessly, penetrated by the despairing sense of their inaccessibility to each other. Then she remembered that Nick, during their last talk together, had seemed as inaccessible, and wondered if, when human souls try to get too near each other, they do not inevitably become mere blurs to each other's vision. She would have liked to say this to Streff, but he would not have understood it either. The sense of loneliness once more enveloped her, and she groped in vain for a word that should reach him. Let me go home alone, won't you? She appealed to him. Alone? She nodded. Tea tomorrow, tomorrow. ... He tried, rather valiantly, to smile. And tomorrow. Whatever is wrong, it needn't prevent my seeing you home. He glanced toward the taxi that awaited them at the end of the deserted drive. No, please. You're in a hurry. Take the taxi. I want immensely a long, long walk by myself. ... Through the streets, with the lights coming out. ... He laid his hand on her arm. Say, my dear, you're not ill? No, I'm not ill. But you may say I am, tonight at the embassy. He released her and drew back. Very well, he answered coldly. And she understood by his tone that the knot was cut, and that at that moment he almost hated her. She turned away, hastening down the deserted alley, flying from him, and knowing, as she fled, that he was still standing there motionless, staring after her, wounded, humiliated, uncomprehending. It was neither her fault nor his. As she fled on toward the lights of the streets, a breath of freedom seemed to blow into her face. Like a weary load, the accumulated hypocrisies of the last months had dropped from her. She was herself again, Nick Susie, and no one else's. She sped on, staring with bright, bewildered eyes at the stately facades of the Lemuette Quarter, the perspectives of bare trees, the awakening glitter of shop windows holding out to her all the things she would never again be able to buy. In an avenue of shops, she paused before a milliner's window and said to herself, "Why shouldn't I earn my living by trimming hats?" She met work girls streaming out under a doorway and scattering to catch trams and omnibuses, and she looked with newly wakened interest at their tired, independent faces. Why shouldn't I earn my living as well as they do? She thought. A little farther on, she passed a sister of charity with softly trotting feet, a calm, anonymous glance, and hands hidden in her capacious sleeves. Susie looked at her and thought, why shouldn't I be a sister, and have no money to worry about, and trot about under a white coif helping poor people? All these strangers on whom she smiled in passing, and glanced back at enviously, were free from the necessities that enslaved her, and would not have known what she meant, if S.E. had told them, that she must have, so much money for her dresses, so much for her cigarettes, so much for bridge and caps and tips, and all kinds of extras, and that at that moment she ought to be hurrying back to a dinner at the British Embassy, where her permanent right to such luxuries was to be solemnly recognized and ratified. The artificiality and unreality of her life overcame her as with stifling fumes. She stopped at a street corner, drawing long panting breaths, as if S.E. had been running a race. Then, slowly, and aimlessly, she began to saunter along a street of small private houses in damp gardens that led to the Avenue du Bois. She sat down on a bench. Not far off, the Arc de Triomphe raised its august bulk, and beyond it a river of light streamed down toward Paris, and the stir of the city's heartbeats troubled the quiet in her bosom. But not for long. She seemed to be looking at it all from the other side of the grave, and as she got up and wandered down the Champs-Élysées, half empty in the evening lull between dusk and dinner, she felt as if the glittering avenue were really changed into the field of shadows from which it takes its name, and as if she were a ghost among ghosts. Halfway home, a weakness of loneliness overcame her, and she seated herself under the trees near the Rond Point. Lines of motors and carriages were beginning to animate the converging thoroughfares, streaming abreast, crossing, winding in and out of each other in a tangle of hurried pleasure-seeking. She caught the light on jewels and shirt fronts, and hard-bored eyes emerging from dim billows of fur and velvet. She seemed to hear what the couples were saying to each other. She pictured the drawing rooms, restaurants, dance halls they were hastening to, the breathless routine that was hurrying them along, as time, the old vacuum cleaner, swept them away with the dust of their carriage wheels. And again the loneliness vanished in a sense of release. Dot, at the corner of the Place de la Concorde she stopped, recognizing a man in evening dress who was hailing a taxi. Their eyes met, and Nelson Vanderlyn came forward. He was the last person she cared to run across, and she shrank back involuntarily. What did he know, what had he guessed, of her complicity in his wife's affairs? No doubt Ellie had blabbed it all out by this time. She was just as likely to confide her love affairs to Nelson as to anyone else, now that the Bockheimer prize was landed. Well, 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 so I've caught you at it. Glad to see you, Susie, my dear. She found her hand cordially clasped in Vanderlyn's, and his round pink face bent on her with all its old urbanity. Did nothing matter, then, in this world she was fleeing from, did no one love or hate or remember? No idea you were in Paris, just got here myself, Vanderlyn continued, visibly delighted at the meeting. Look here, don't suppose you're out of a job this evening by any chance, and would come and cheer up a lone bachelor, eh? No? You are? Well, that's luck for once. I say, where shall we go? One of the places where they dance, I suppose? Yes, I twirl the light fantastic once in a while myself. Got to keep up with the times. Hold on, taxi. Here I'll drive you home first, and wait while you jump into your toggery. Lots of time. As he steered her toward the carriage she noticed that he had a gouty limp, and pulled himself in after her with difficulty. Mayn't I come as I am, Nelson? I don't feel like dancing. Let's go and dine in one of those nice smoky little restaurants by the Place de la Bourse. He seemed surprised, but relieved at the suggestion, and they rolled off together. In a corner at Bodge's they found a quiet table, screened from the other diners, and while Vanderlyn adjusted his eyeglasses, to study the cart, Susie stole a long look at him. He was dressed with even more than his usual formal trimness, and she detected, in an ultra-flat wristwatch and discreetly expensive waistcoat buttons, an attempt at smartness altogether new. His face had undergone the same change. Its familiar look of worn optimism had been, as it were, done up to match his clothes, as though a sort of moral cosmetic had made him pinker, shinier and sprightlier without really rejuvenating him. A thin veil of high spirits had merely been drawn over his face, as the shining strands of hair were skillfully brushed over his baldness. "Here. Cart de Vins, waiter. What champagne, Susie?" He chose, fastidiously, the best the cellar could produce, grumbling a little at the bourgeois character of the dishes. "Capital food of its kind, no doubt, but coarsish, don't you think? Well, I don't mind. It's rather a jolly change from the luxe cooking. A new sensation, I'm all for new sensations, ain't you, my dear?" He refilled their champagne glasses, flung an arm sideways over his chair, and smiled at her with a foggy benevolence. As the champagne flowed, his confidences flowed with it. "Suppose you know what I'm here for, this divorce business? We wanted to settle it quietly without a fuss, and of course Paris. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter."